It's strange what we tend to remember from childhood, but I remember one day when I was very, very young, having learned a new word I was going to try out on my mother. And I told my mother, "Mother, you're ignorant." That was not a happy day that I recall. We don't like being called ignorant. We don't enjoy it. And my mother didn't need to hear it. But sometimes we do need to hear it. Sometimes there are occasions when someone needs to tell us, "You don't know what you need to know." And I think that was the case with the Apostle Paul as he was writing to the Corinthians for a second time when he said to them this, as he warned them about things that were happening, he said, "Lest Satan should take advantage of you, for we are not ignorant of his devices." Now, in stating that, what the apostle was applying is they knew what might very well happen, but yet in some ways they were kind of trending toward the idea of ignorance. And therefore, Paul needed to come and to teach them the truth of what was going on. And I think as the Corinthians heard this, we too at times need to be reminded that we don't need to be ignorant. We need to be reminded that we are people who very much are under the view of Satan, that his desire is to destroy us, his desire is to see us where he is. And as the Corinthians, Paul would say to us, you don't need to be ignorant of his devices. This morning I want to talk about three ways that we can be ignorant. Three ways that the devil is quite interested in getting us just to ignore some things about him. And as we consider that, the first of those I'd like for us to consider is ignorance of just who he is as being our enemy. It's interesting, this week we remembered September 11th, the 9/11 attacks. What a horrible day that probably all of us have in our memory that we can think about if we're old enough anyway, of what went on that day. What's also interesting is that we've had two presidents who have served in the post 9/11 United States. One who was very much taking war to the enemy. The other who came about later, as Americans were growing very war weary. And as a young senator, he ran on the platform of saying, "If you elect me as president, I'll sit down across the table from our enemies. I'll talk to them face to face." Americans liked that, and they voted for him not only once, but twice. But if you notice, the news media has not covered any of these meetings that have taken place for the reason that he's never sat down across the table from our enemies. Because what a young senator learned when he became president of the United States is that he did not know our enemies before. Now, with the knowledge, with the intelligence, with the understanding, he realized what he was facing. And so must we have that knowledge of our enemy, because our enemy is very, very clever. This is so well seen in really a contrast that we can make between he and God and how they seek to be known. As we think about God, he refuses to be known as anything else but God. He refuses to accept a false identity. How well that came across at the golden calf when he told the people, "You will not remember me as some golden cow." And he sent Moses to teach them the lesson, to show them that he is God and they must come to understand who he is. The Israelites continued with their problems of going into idolatry. And even by the time we come to the opening of the New Testament and the times of the writings of the Apostle Paul, we see idolatry still being a problem. Look with me over to Romans chapter 1. And as we look at this condemnation of both Jew and Gentile, we find here those who were given over to idolatry. And listen to what the apostle says. He says, beginning in verse 20, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their understanding, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And let's note just the first part of verse 24 when Paul says, therefore God gave them up. Why? Because they did not know Him. It says that they knew Him, but not in the sense of understanding who He is, because Paul says, though they knew Him, they traded His image for those of four-footed animals. They turned Him into an idol, and God said, I'll have nothing to do with that. But let's think about our enemy on the other hand. Satan has no problem whatsoever, and in fact is quite pleased when we don't know exactly who he is. In fact, he's mastered the strategy of saying, let me deceive you into thinking something I'm not. As we consider what we're told about that, we go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And as the apostle is writing here, he's telling them about these false teachers, false apostles who came in. And he draws the conversation back to Satan himself. And as we look at verse 13, it says, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan himself disguises as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond with their deeds. Paul says, we ought not to be surprised because Satan himself has mastered fooling people into thinking that he is something that he's not. Here is the most wicked being that we know of who has taken himself and made some believe he is an angel of light. You think he cares about that? You think he wants to clear that up and say, no, I'm the devil? No. Because we are much more likely to fall to him in this than if we know his true identity. He's always enjoyed playing the good guy. You remember back in Genesis chapter 3, God has told Adam and Eve, you shall not eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. And the devil slithers up in his snake skin, and he says, what's God told you? And Eve says, well, if we eat of this tree, we will die. And the devil says, you will not surely die. What God is concerned about is that if you eat of this tree, you're going to know good from evil. Except what he says is, you're going to be as smart as God. And the woman falls for it, and she gives to her husband, and he eats. And suddenly they learn this one who tried to come across as the good guy was deceitful. They were ignorant of his devices, and because of that, they were cast out of this paradise of God. And so it's no surprise to us that those who follow Satan have continued in the same way. You remember Matthew chapter 7. He says, beware of those who come to you in sheep's clothing, for inwardly they are ravenous wolves. And even today, those who are irreligious understand the Lord's illustration here of a wolf coming in sheep's clothing, because that's what their father has done. That's what the devil has done. He has sought to deceive. But even in more modern times, Satan has enjoyed being marginalized. You see, what God will not accept, Satan is quite happy with. If I were to go to the citizens of the United States today, perhaps elsewhere in the world, and I were to say, what does the devil look like? You know the description, don't you? There would be people who would say, well, he's red and he's got these horns and he's got kind of this crooked pitchfork tail and he walks around. We think of him as a cartoon character. In our comic strips, he's the little guy sitting on the shoulder, you know, trying to kind of in a comic way convince us to do wrong. Oh, I can guarantee you he's happy with that. And he is happy with the idea of people who say he's nothing more than a myth. And he's happy with people who say he is just the product of an overly religious mind. Those things are fine. Because what that means is that we've taken our eyes off the enemy. We're ignorant of who he is. And because of that, we have given him the season of opportunity to bring us down. When we consider these things, we should also remember that he is also very clever at deceiving us into who should be worshiped. You want to know how brash and bold Satan is? Satan tried to convince God himself to worship the devil. You remember back in Matthew chapter 4, as these temptations are being given, the devil comes to Christ and he says, for the third temptation listed in Matthew, if you'll just simply bow down and worship me, all of this will be yours. For a long time, I thought that was the easiest of the temptations. Here's Christ, God himself in the flesh. Would he ever bow down to Satan? As I have thought about that, I believe this might be the most difficult of the three. Because what Satan is saying is, you see all these kingdoms out here, all of these that bow to the prince of this age, they're yours. I'll give them to you. Just bow down and worship. We know that the cross was in Jesus' mind. Here was a way around that. Here was a way to circumvent the cross to maybe get something that he wanted. Oh, but Christ was wiser than that. He knew he was dealing with the father of lies. He knew the trickery, the chicanery that went on with Satan. And he simply says to him, you shall worship the Lord God, and him only shall you serve. And Christ set the standard, and he said, you don't bow to this one. But God's creation hasn't been quite as clever. We've had problems with this. In fact, I'd like for you to go with me back to the book of Malachi chapter 3 here for just a minute. You'll recall Malachi is set up as though God and the people are speaking. And we come to Malachi chapter 3, and as we look here, notice what the people are saying in this exchange. We're going to start in verse 13. Here the Lord is speaking. And he says, your words have been very hard against me, says the Lord. But you say, how have we spoken against you? You have said, it is vain to serve God. What is the profit of our keeping his charge or of walking as in mourning before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the arrogant blessed. Evildoers not only prosper, but they put God to the test and they escape. You listening to what they're saying? What they're saying is, this God who we're supposed to worship, who we're supposed to serve, he's better to the bad guys than he is to the good guys. They're striking at the judicial righteousness of God, and they're saying you've got it all wrong. You think Satan was happy? You think Satan was pleased when they've got all of this mixed up and the God that they're to be worshiping is actually the God that they're condemning? That's what happens. And that is relevant in modern times as much as it ever was. We are living in some frightening times. I don't know if you've been paying attention lately of what's going on in Oklahoma. Several months ago, we talked about the idea of the monument that they're wanting to set up to Satan right there beside the Ten Commandments Memorial in Oklahoma City. That's continuing, by the way. They've got it completed, just seeking the opportunity. This week as well, or at least this month, there's also been a black mass that's been called for Oklahoma City, where people who are devil worshipers are going to get together, and in a mock celebration of the Catholic mass, they're going to honor their father, the devil. You think Satan's disappointed with that? You think he's unhappy that right here in a country whose founders were pretty solid, at least in their regard that there was an Almighty and a respect for his word, that there are citizens of that country who have now turned in that kind of direction? But I tell you, we don't have to be that far out to be very solid in Satan's corner. Anytime that we do not profess the superiority of God in every way, we are allowing Satan to have the victory because we have forgotten who the enemy is. We are ignorant of his devices. But we understand also that not only can we be ignorant of the enemy, we can also be ignorant of the enemy's battle plan. I tell you, you study military history and it is littered with all of these situations on the battlefield where somebody underestimated the power of the enemy. And it ends badly every time. We do that also anytime we are not very aware of what Satan is up to. Let me say this at the beginning, though. What we've got to understand fully is that God has already won the battle. You know, there are times when Jesus gives us statements without a lot of explanation, just kind of in passing. One of those is found over in Luke chapter 10. The 72 have returned from their commission. They're amazed that the demons are subject to them in the name of Jesus. Jesus answers by saying this, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." What's he saying? I am more powerful than he is. I was superior as he fell. We get a little more glimpse into this from something John writes over in the book of Revelation. If you go with me over to chapter 12 of Revelation, we find here that John is recording for us about these things going on with Satan, verse 9 beginning. Here he writes this, "And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them." But then listen. "But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because that he knows his time is short." Those Roman Christians needed to be on guard, and we need to be on guard as well. Satan is defeated, God is victorious. The question now is simply, who is going to stay on the side of God and who's going to be on the side of Satan? And so that's what Satan tries to do. And I can assure us that God's victory gives no allowance for our ignorance. We can't sit back and say, well, God has won. There's really nothing else we've got to think about. Because here's what the devil wants to do. One by one, he wants to pick us off. And I think that's well illustrated by something that said to the Lord, or by the Lord to Cain. Very early in the history of man, Cain is upset over the sacrifices. God says to him, "Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." I can't help but believe Peter had this in mind as he said, "Satan is like a roaring lion seeking whom he can devour." God says evil, wickedness, the devil is ready to pounce. So how does he do that? What does he do? Satan understands he's defeated. And he understands there's only one way that he can hurt the Lord. And that's one by one by one, picking off those who are created in the image of God. You see, every time we allow wickedness to rule over us, Satan's victorious. Why? Because we're ignorant of his battle plan. And I think we've got to be very aware of that. Let me point out two ways that I think Satan is so effective in this. And both of these tie in with the idea that he convinces us there's not really much of a battle anyway. The first of these is when really he convinces us that there's not a whole lot of reason to fight. And he does this through discouragement. We are a people who many times tend to focus on our weaknesses and our failings to the exclusion of the mercy and grace of God. We think, I've sinned, I've fallen, I've sinned again, I've repented, I've sinned again. And before too long, Satan tries to convince us, well, there's really no use of you going on. Why are you even trying anymore? Isn't it obvious that you're a failure? Isn't it obvious that you can't stand up? Isn't it obvious that sin is too strong? And he beats us down and he keeps out of our minds the fact that we have a God in heaven who is not only rooting for us, but there to help us every step of the way. We cannot be a people who forget the grace and mercy of God. Yes, we sin. Yes, we fall. But God is there to lift us back up. That's the story of salvation. And any time you and I begin focusing on ourselves to the exclusion of God, the battle is won for Him. Because you and I are not going to get to heaven on our good graces and merits. We are not going to get to heaven by our perfect keeping of the law of God. The apostle cleared that up for us when he said, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That is not to say we are unconcerned about our weaknesses. That is not to say we don't seek forgiveness when we make a mistake. But it is to say we cannot forget that we are saved by the grace of God. Let me go to the other extreme. Sometimes Satan says to us this. He says, look, the battle is over because really you've achieved. And he applies to our materialistic side. He says, look around. Look at what you've got. You live in a nice house, you got a nice bank account, you've got insurance, you got your retirement, you've got your health, everything's going well, you got your kids, you got your grandkids around. I sometimes shudder to think how many people would take God up on an offer. If God were to say to them, look, you got heaven, or I can leave it for you just like it is right now. I'll just make that continuing for you right here. And someone says, you know, it's pretty good. Satan's won. Because what he's convinced us of is that everything in religion is based on materialism, and I can be rather tepid and lukewarm in my service to God, do enough to kind of salve my conscience, to go to church a time or two a week, but everything's good. Satan's won the battle, if that's the case. What I want you and I to understand is this. He's convinced us, if we give up on the struggle, that somehow He can give us what God cannot. And if you and I fall for that lie, we are ignorant of the battle plan. Let me mention just one other ignorance this morning. And that's the ignorance of ungodliness. And what we do is we take the verse that we started out with and we drop it back in its context. Passage that was read for us this morning, verses 5 through 11, tell us about the Corinthians. They had a brother who had been wrong and they had taken action on him. They had done the right thing. This may very well be the brother who's mentioned back in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. I couldn't prove that, but it seems to fit. And if that is indeed the case, here is one who had his father's wife, and the Apostle Paul gets all over the congregation because of that. And he tells them, deliver this one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh in order to save his soul. We come over to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and we find that that's been done, and the Apostle now says, you've got a decision that you must make. You've done the right thing. But now you must forgive him. Or else you give Satan the advantage. And we are not ignorant of his devices. The Apostle Paul is saying, if you withhold forgiveness from this brother who has repented, you've won the battle for Satan. And that presents us with a type of ignorance that I think we all have to be aware of. The idea that we are doing something in the name of God, but yet in a very ungodly manner. In this situation in particular, it's the idea of being cold-hearted. Here is a brother who needs forgiveness. Here is a brother who needs to be welcomed back into the family of God. He's made his life right. And the apostle is warning them, don't let your heart turn cold toward that brother. Can you imagine some of the conversations that went on? Perhaps you had a brother or two or a sister or two who are talking, and they're saying, you know, I'm just not really sure about him yet. I'm just not really sure that he is sincere in his forgiveness. And perhaps we need to make it a little harder on him until we are convinced that he is right in the eyes of God. If that was the case, I can tell you it wouldn't be the only time friendly fire has been issued and destroyed a soul. Because if Satan can ever convince us to turn on each other, his work is done. And we begin to do all kinds of things in the name of God, but yet we can find no support for those things within the Word of God. We begin to develop attitudes that take the place of God. I believe that's what could have happened here. I think that's what the apostle is concerned about. That what may very well have happened is that they could have started viewing themselves as the standard and saying things have got to be done to my satisfaction. Remember a group that did that? How much favor did the Lord show to the Pharisees? A people who had said, we'll take the responsibility of being the standard. You'll answer to us and we'll make sure you're right before God. You ever notice that the harshest words that Jesus spoke were spoken to the people who considered themselves to be the most religious? They were working ungodliness in the name of God. They were promoting ideas that the Lord did not. And when we do that, when we deal harshly with a brother who needs to be shown love, when we are refusing to show the godly standards that we need, we become very much like that. Let me say one other thing. That can also happen when we excuse ourselves from the standard of God, because those two really fit together. We become the standard and we put God's side in a secondary position. How often do we see that happening? Some years ago, I was having a Bible study with a group of teenagers. And in this particular study, we were talking about instrumental music, some questions about it and such. And after I got through defending a cappella singing and the deletion of musical instruments from worship, I asked them just to write down what they thought. And I remember one young man who I'm sure was quite sincere. He said, you know, when I play my hymns on the guitar to God, I just feel so much closer to Him. I just feel like I'm doing a really good thing. And I fear many times that's the attitude we get on a whole host of issues. When we say, I feel, I think, rather than what God thinks, Christ summarily dismisses that in one statement when He says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. We do not excuse what the Lord has not excused. We do not condemn where the Lord has not condemned. We do not put ourselves in the judgment seat of God. We understand that He is the standard, and we must follow. However, Satan is pleased if we ignorantly pursue God by ungodly means. He has won the battle. As we consider these forms of ignorance, let me end by just simply reminding us of Satan's final outcome. The Lord said, for He will say to those on His left, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. If we think that Satan is sitting on some fiery little throne in hell and he's kind of the king over it and people are going at his command, no. He is defeated. And he will be punished eternally for what he's done. But let me remind us also of those who are ignorant of his ways, what the Lord says the outcome will be. As he tells the Thessalonians, he says, they will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His might. Hellfire and brimstone and maggots and every other thing that's used to describe hell is a frightening thing. But I believe the most frightening thing is housed within this verse. We are away from the Lord. The worst, most immoral, atheistic person, while he is on this earth, enjoys the blessings of God. But when that final day comes, no more. Nothing else good. Hopeless for eternity. And I ask you, is that not a terribly frightening thing? And so as we consider the ignorance of His devices, let me just end by saying this. Our ignorance is Satan's bliss. Because if we choose to be unknowing about His ways, He wins. And I don't want that for anyone. Hard thoughts, tough lessons, things we really don't enjoy talking about a whole lot. But yet God's put them there for a reason. And He says to us, I don't want you to come to me because you're scared of somebody else. He says, I don't want your service because you're scared of hell. But He says, I want you to make an informed decision. Because in choosing to ignore me, this is what you're choosing. How much better to come to a God who in His love and mercy, as we were reminded of around the Lord's table this morning, gave His Son as a sacrifice so that this doesn't have to be our fate. So that we're not only not ignorant of Satan's devices, we are also not ignorant of God's devices. And how much better that He would give His Son so that you and I could be saved.